When Saul saw David go out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, "Abner, whose son is this young man?" Abner says, "As your soul lives, O king, I do not know." The king said, "Inquire whose son this stripling is." On David's return from killing the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And David answered, "I am the son of your servant Jesse from Bethlehem." When David had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was bound to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Saul took David that day and would not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. Jonathan stripped himself of the robe he was wearing and gave it to David, and his armor, and even his sword and his bow and his belt. David went out and was successful wherever Saul sent him. As a result, Saul set him over the army, and all the people, even the servants of Saul, approved. This is the word of the Lord. There you have it, in black and white. The Bible affirms that two men can love one another and make a covenant to each other. Are there any questions? For some people, this is a startling text. It's like eating a bowl of oatmeal and finding a pebble. What's that? Where did that come from? David has just accomplished the ultimate macho deed. With the simplicity of a sling, he has taken down Goliath, the fearsome Philistine giant. His valiant deed has chased away the Philistine army, at least for a while. It's an impressive moment on the battlefield, and King Saul asks his general, "Who is that kid? Where did he come from?" And neither one of them know. When David arrives to introduce himself to the royal court, the head of the Philistines still in his hand as a trophy, Jonathan, the firstborn son of the king, takes an instant liking to him. Actually, it's more than a liking. The storyteller says the soul of Jonathan was bound to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And when David moves into the palace at the king's demand, Jonathan makes a covenant with David, and the storyteller says a second time, because he loved him with his own soul. This is the word of the Lord. It is no surprise to all of us who remember the family tree of David. He had a great-grandmother named Ruth. Ruth made a covenant with a woman named Naomi. They took a pledge to one another and said, "Where you go, I will go, and your people shall be my people." Know where I found this one? I heard it right here 15 years ago when the lady preacher read that passage at my wedding. As two divorced people pledged their lives to one another, and I took her people as my people, and she took mine as hers. Now, the objection may be sounded. If David had a great-grandmother who made a covenant with another woman, there must have been a man in the picture, too, if only because David's grandfather had to be born in order for David to have a father. That's true. Ruth married a man eventually named Boaz, and she did that after she had already made a covenant with Naomi. Now, if all of this sounds confusing, I'll simply point out that sometime after David and Jonathan made their covenant together, David married Jonathan's little sister. Her name was Michal, and she was the first of many, many wives. If that sounds weird, you should hear about the dowry that her father demanded. All I know is this is biblical morality, and I don't argue much with the Bible. Is it possible for two men to love one another? Good question. It's a question that makes some people twitch in various societies and cultures as they've expanded and declined. There have been many ways that households have been formed and people have chosen to live together. In the past few weeks, just in the congregation, I've come across three different people who were raised by their grandparents. The mother and the father were nowhere in the mix. I also think of some unmarried people I know, Beverly in Manhattan and David in New Jersey among them, who felt God's calling to adopt orphans as their own daughters. There have been costly commitments on their part, and it's been a lot more courageous than anything I would ever do. There are many different ways to construct a family, to build a household, and the Bible certainly reveals that too. Again, the objection may be sounded, well, what about the rest of the Bible? What about Paul and what he said to the anything goes practices of the Roman Empire? Well, it's there. And a closer look reveals that most of those texts are addressing abuse and idolatry, which is hardly the same thing as covenant making. Our other objectors will hearken back even further to the purity codes of Leviticus, where the ancient temple priests declared what was clean and unclean. Eating lobster, for instance, that's unclean. A law that God himself undermines in the 10th chapter of Acts. Touching a leper, unclean. And Jesus himself steps over that law to heal lepers that he regarded as fellow human beings. But let's stay with David and Jonathan for a bit. Because we must never talk about matters of the heart in the abstract. As if there are timeless principles or scientific propositions that govern what is right or wrong in human relationships. David and Jonathan are not theoretical principles. They are real people in flesh and blood, and they love one another. They have names. They have lives. The Bible says they have souls. In fact, three times in the first verse of chapter 18, the Bible speaks of their souls touching one another. In our parlance, we might say they're soulmates or soul partners or soul friends. In the old King James Bible, it's translated, their souls were knit together. Now that's the essence of love. Have you ever known somebody whose soul is knit to yours? After he was sent to a boarding school as a teenager, the author Frederick Buechner described his first real friend. Like me, he was no good at sports and consequently disliked them, or possibly the other way around. Like me, though through divorce rather than death, he had lost a father. Like me, he was a kind of oddball, plump and not very tall then, with braces on his teeth and glasses that kept slipping down the short bridge of his nose, and a rather sarcastic, sophisticated way of speaking that tended to pit people off. And for that reason, and for the reason he was a good deal brighter than most of us, including me, boys tended to make his life miserable. But it was Jimmy who became my first real friend, and it was through coming to know him that perhaps I was not, as I had suspected, alone in the universe and the only one of my kind. He was another who saw the world enough as I saw it to to make me believe that maybe it was the way the world actually was. Souls knit together. It's a brilliant description. It describes really well how I've come to love the people that I've loved. There's a commonality, a shared space, a stunning realization that we are not alone and that we don't have to be alone. We are partners who share values. We can make commitments. We're seatmates on spaceship Earth and thoroughly grounded. What happens to one of us will alter what happens to the other one of us. And in the days after Goliath the giant is defeated, Jonathan and David agree to get through life together. It is the beginning of an extensive friendship, the longest recorded relationship like this in the entire Bible. It is a life-giving bond, and it turns out to be a life-saving bond as well. Because within just a few paragraphs of the text, King Saul, Jonathan's father, becomes intensely jealous of David's success. One time after another, he takes a spear, throws it at the shepherd boy, tries to perforate him and pin him to the wall. Jonathan becomes David's confidant and his advocate, which then only drives old King Saul further toward insanity. Now, some might suggest this is the nature of their relationship. David is in need, and Jonathan takes pity on him. Or David was the hero, and Jonathan admires him. Or, as in the case of many human relationships, it begins and develops as two needy souls circle around one another. But the biblical text is repeatedly clear. Their souls are knit together. Or, Jonathan loved David as he loved his own life. Or even after that terrible day when Jonathan and his father are killed in battle, David sings this lament: "I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Greatly beloved were you to me. Your love to me was wonderful, surpassing the love of women." There it is. In the Bible. Who am I to argue with that? So I reflect today on the deep friendships, deep relationships I've known in my life. And I invite you to reflect on yours as well. There are people I've loved so much I would walk through fire for them. How about you? And how did those relationships begin? Probably relatively unimpressive. The teacher assigned you to sit together in English class, or you met in the gym after work, or you noticed the pretty eyes of someone in the dormitory lounge. I think of my great friend Jim, who voted to approve my candidacy as a minister in 1981, had second thoughts about it ever since, and has now been my roommate at countless preaching conferences ever since. Or my dear friend Virginia, lost to us in February through breast cancer. She could complete my sentences and then try to improve them. Or my old friend Al, the saxophonist, first a terrifying teacher, then a colleague, now an occasional employee, and as close to a true blue soulmate as I've ever had. Or my wife. Mutual friends tried to fix us up when we were both recovering from our divorces, and they quickly discovered we didn't need their help. C.S. Lewis has a wonderful book on love, The Four Loves. He suggests that God's hidden hand is behind all of these relationships, which sometimes appear to begin so randomly. Here's what he says. "We think we have chosen our peers. In reality, a few years' difference in the dates of our births, a few more miles between certain houses, the choice of one university instead of another, the accident of a topic being raised or not raised at the first meeting. Any of these chances might have kept us apart. But for a Christian who said there are, strictly speaking, no chances, a secret master of ceremonies has been at work. Christ, who said to the disciples, "You have not chosen me, but I've chosen you," can truly say to a group of Christian friends, "You have not chosen one another, but I have chosen you for one another." He says the friendship is not a reward for our discriminating and good taste in finding one another out. It is the instrument by which God reveals to each of us the beauties of one another. So Jonathan and David find their souls knit together. I don't know what that was about. Were they good friends, soulmates, companions? More? I don't know. In a real mystery, God brought them together. And what a blessing that neither one of them had to negotiate the first and next couple of chapters of 1 Samuel alone. So I figure, you know, you've got to have something to talk about at lunch. Maybe you could talk about this. As for me, it's a reminder to all of us that love is a gift of God, the giving of God's own essence to God's own children. From time to time, we are nudged out of our isolation and our independence, and we are brought more deeply alive by those who reveal their beauty and also reveal ours. I sincerely hope you have people that you love without hesitation or restriction. And I deeply hope that you know there are people who love you. Because love is the greatest gift of God. And when we gather on a Sunday, we give thanks for a lot of things, but today let's give thanks for that gift. However love finds us, whatever shape it takes, however we're surprised and astonished by it. Love is the gift that is so far beyond and above our all too common tendency to conflict, division, short-sighted judgment, or early dismissal. So we simply affirm and celebrate the divine truth that God is love, and those who abide in love abide in God, and God abides in them. Have a good lunch. See you next week.